Yeah, so right now we're looking at an Agadah concerning Chizkiyahu HaMelech and the exile of the 10 tribes. And remember, Chizkiyahu HaMelech lives around 100 years before the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. And this is the time when you have the two kingdoms, the northern kingdom of the 10 tribes and the southern kingdom of just the tribes of Yehuda and Binyamin. And that's where the Beis HaMikdash is located. And the story is that Sancheriv destroyed the northern kingdom and exiled the 10 tribes, and these are the so-called lost 10 tribes. And then he went to the south, and he decimated much of Malchus Yehuda, but the last minutes, his army was destroyed right outside of the walls of Yerushalayim, and that was considered to be a great miracle. And if you remember, Chizkiyahu HaMelech could in fact have been the Mashiach, had he said a proper prayer and a proper shiva to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Gemara has many comments on this, and the Gemara says, Tana Mishmei Rav Yeshua ben Karcha. A Tana taught in the name of Rav Yeshua ben Karcha. Now Rav Yeshua ben Karcha is a Tana, but it's interesting, according to some commentaries, he was actually Rav Kiva's son. So you ask the obvious kasha. So why is he Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha? So Korcha actually means bald-headed person. Now it's a little strange to me. So Rabbi Yeshua, the son of the bald-headed guy, which is a little strange to call Rabbi Akiva that. But part of it is it might be a term of endearment, a term of affection. And part of it would simply be bald, not in the sense of whether he was bald or not, but in the sense that he pulled out of the Torah everything that was there. He was able to get everything out of the Torah. Kav Yochan, as if you would say, he plucked the Torah bald because he took everything out of the Torah that a human being could possibly get. But be it as it may, it was taught in the name of Yeshua ben Korcha the following idea. Parai cherev biatzmai. Parai blasphemed Hashem himself. Paro issued words of blasphemy against the Almighty directly. Nifra HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mimenu Biatzma. Hashem punished Paro directly. Remember, Makas Bechoros and everything else were not through an angel, but rather HaKadosh Baruch Hu Bechavoda Uviatzma punished Paro. In other words, since Paro himself sinned directly against God, God punishes him directly. He didn't act through a shaliach. Hashem does not act through a shaliach. Contrast, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha says, Sancheriv blasphemed Hashem, not directly. Sancheriv had a general, Rav Shaka, and Rav Shaka was actually a Jew. Remember, Rav Shaka was the Tokyo Rose who spoke to the Jewish armies in Hebrew, that Hashem is not with you, etc. So Sancheriv blasphemed Hashem through a shaliach. That is why God punished him through a shaliach, as the verse says, Sancheriv's army was destroyed by an angel of Hashem. So unlike Makas Bechoras and even Kriyas Yamsef, which HaKadosh Baruch Hu did, Bechvoda Uviatzma, without a shaliach, again, it's a mida keneged mida. You sin directly, Hashem punishes you directly. You sin through a shaliach, HaKadosh Baruch Hu punishes you via a shaliach. Now, of course, it's hard for us to understand exactly what difference does it make? In other words, we would normally assume that a sin that you commit yourself is more severe than a sin that you commit through a shaliach. But on the other hand, is it more severe to be punished by Hashem directly or through a shaliach if the outgrowth of the punishment or the outcome of the punishment is exactly the same? I mean, in both cases, the Mitzrayim died at Kriyas Yamsuf and Sancheriv's army died there. So what exactly is the extra element of punishment that one gets when it comes directly from Hashem? That's not so pashut here. In other words, it's hard to hear the mita keneged mita. In other words, I understand, you know, the worse your sin, the worse your punishment, but you don't really see a worsening punishment here. Unless the idea is that if you're punished by Hashem, then, you know, on some level, maybe it's eternal, and even after the neshama leaves the guf, the punishments continue, as opposed to a shaliach. A shaliach has a limited role here. So when the shaliach kills you, the shaliach is finished. he can no longer do any harm to you after that. That might be a possible thing. By the way, I think you see here from the Gemara, an interesting chiddush. All of us know that Makas Bechoros was directly by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what it says in the Haggadah. Ani v'lo Malach, Ani v'lo Sarach, right? Hashem says, I did it myself. There's no Shaliach. Although you may ask Akasha, what do you mean there's no Shaliach? Doesn't Hashem say, if you put blood on the sides of your door, the blood of the Korban Pesach, I will not allow the Mashkas, I will not allow the angel of destruction to enter your house. But what angel of destruction was there? Makas Bechoros was Hashem directly. That's a famous stira that people ask. How can I say Makas Bechoros was only from Hashem? What about the idea that the Mashkas could not enter your house when there is blood, implying there's a Malach HaMashkas? So there are different answers, but the simplest answer is that there were two things that happened. The miraculous killing of the firstborn was only HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. But there happened to be the Malach HaMavis on duty. Hashem didn't take over the Malach HaMavis' normal job. Some people were to die naturally. So when Hashem promises Bnei Yisrael that nobody is going to be harmed, he is not only telling them that I am not going to kill, through Makas Bechoros, any Jew that is keeping this, but even the Malach HaMavis will not be allowed to do his natural job. In other words, nobody died naturally. No Jew died naturally the night of Makas Bechoros, right? That's the contradiction. Okay. But be it as it may, what we know from the Haggadah is Makas Bechoros was done by Hashem himself. This is the first time we actually see that Kriyas Yamsuf is also done by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Bichvodo V'yatzma. Now, that does raise a few questions, because in Parshas B'Shalach, where it does talk about Kriyas Yamsuf, it says that the angel of Hashem stood and separated between the Egyptians who wanted to come forward. In other words, when everybody entered the Yamsuf, we couldn't... Well, the Yamsuf split, the Jews entered, but how do you prevent the Egyptians from following the Jews so close that they don't get drowned? So what had to be was that the Egyptians couldn't move for many hours till all of the Jews got out. Then they can move in, and then the sea closes. So how is that possible? So the Pasuk says, a Malach Hashem blocked the Egyptians the whole night, preventing them from moving forward. And then only in the morning, the Malach left, they come in and the water closes. But so that implies that a Malach had a role. But once again, that's not so much of a kasha. Hashem split the water. The Malach was just the one that blocked the Jews, the Egyptians, from moving forward. Okay. All right. Now we then have another drasha from Rav Yeshua ben Levi. Rav Yeshua ben Levi is an interesting person. It's not clear to us if he's a Tana or an Amora. He's actually a member of the transitional generation. He is not mentioned in any Mishnah, but he is mentioned in the Raisos. So he was like a Talmud of Rav Yehuda HaNasi, but he was a little late to be an actual Tana in the Mishnah itself. So Rav Yeshua ben Levi says the following: My Dechsev, it is written in Sancheirev's blasphemy, which he used Rav Shaka to communicate, and this is what Sancheirev says: V'yata, and now, ha mi baladei Hashem olisi ala oretz azos lashchisa? Do you think I have come here to destroy this land without God's permission? His argument is that if I've been successful, it's because Hashem wants to destroy you. That's how he's trying to demoralize them. Think I could have destroyed this land without Hashem? Hashem Amar Eli. It is God that told me, says Sancheirev via Rav Shaka, Alei el ha'aretz hazos v'hishchisa. Go up against this land and destroy it. So Rav Yeshua ben Levi explains, Mahi. I mean, Sancheirev presumably could not have just made up a lie. What words of Hashem could Sancheirev possibly distort into meaning Hashem wants him to destroy Yerushalayim? The answer is, the Navi did say something. Dishamei l'Navi. Sancheirev heard Navi Yeshayahu say these words. And these are the words of Yeshayahu the Navi. Yan ki mo'as ha'om hazeh esmei hashiluach ha'hilchim la'at u'mesais esratzin u'ben remalyahu l'chein hine Hashem male aleihem esmei ha'nahor ha'atsumim barabim esmelech ashur. Okay. This pasuk says the following. Because, this is the Navi speaking to Bnei Yisrael that Sancheirav had over, was aware of. Because this nation has despised the waters of the Shiloach, which flow very, very slowly. And instead, I'm going to first translate it just literally. And instead rejoiced with Ratzin and Ben Ramalyahu, these are two people. Therefore, I will bring up to them the torrential river waters of the king of Assyria. Now, Rav Yosef then remarks, if it wouldn't be for the Aramaic Targum of this pasuk, we really wouldn't know what's going on. What does it mean? Because they despise the Shiloh. Remember, you know what the Shiloh is, right? We have the Shiloh today. The Shiloh is a spring which gushes forth, and it was one of the main, not today, I mean, the spring is still there, but in biblical times, it was one of the main sources of water for Yerushalayim. It's called Mei Shiloh, the waters that gush forth. Where is Mei Shiloh located? Mei Shiloh is located nearby. It's in the village of Silawan, right near the Kotel, right? If you go outside Shar HaAshkos, right outside, you know, the gate that's closer to the Kotel, and just cross the street next to that souvenir, that Arab souvenir stand, and walk a few blocks inwards, you will reach the very famous spring of Silawan. Years ago, I wanted to go with my son to see the famous Silawans. I figured, well, probably just, but you know, once you wander in too many, you're in an Arab village too deeply, I said, let's get out of here. So I never got a chance to see it myself. But it is considered to be a makom kadosh in some ways, because it was the main source of water for the Beis HaMikdash. And there are people who go there, that they even bottle the water from the Shiloach. They sell it like holy water. And some people go there for tashlich. But again, I really wouldn't advise it today. Although Silawan is a relatively peaceful village. Now, the pasuk says, because the people have despised Mei Shiloach. So Rav Yosef says, I wouldn't have known what that meant. What do you mean they despised the Mei Shiloach? So the Targum explains this as an expression. Mei Shiloach are waters that move slowly. It's not like a gushing fountain with a lot of force. So that's a mashal for Malchei Beis David, the kings of Beis David, who were modest. They were humble. They weren't imposing themselves on people. And yet, what happened was that many Jews were turning away from Malchus Beis David, and they wanted to have foreign alliances with other kings. Ritzin was the king of Syria, Aram, and Pekach ben Ramalyahu was a particular king of the 10 tribes. So what does the pasuk say now, now that we take the Targum in? Because you despised the kings of David, and instead you turned to the kings of Syria, not Assyria, Syria, and the northern kingdom, and Mida Kedek Mida, you despised the slow, gentle waters of the Shiloach, I will give you the torrential waters of the king of Assyria, who will sweep everything away. Right? Shiloach is too gentle, I'll give you a tsunami. Okay, so Sancheirav heard of this prophecy, and Sancheirav actually said, yeah, God has given me permission to move forward. Okay, this is, now the Gemara is going to explain, so why was Sancheirav punished if Hashem gave him the green light? Okay, we'll look at that in a moment. But this is the Nevuah, now it was not directed to Sancheirav, it was directed to Bnei Yisrael, but this was the Nevuah that Sancheirav claimed gave him the green light to destroy Jerusalem. Now, just a little aside here. Yosef says, and this is an expression of Yosef, liked the Targum on the Nevi'im a lot. If it wouldn't be for the Targum of this Pasuk, I wouldn't have known what it means. And the Targum of the Pasuk says that the waters of Shiluach is a metaphor for the gentle, slow waters of Malchus Beis Dovid. And that's the Chiddush of the Targum. So first of all, what is the Targum on Nevi'im? Right? We know that there is an Aramaic translation of the Torah that is attributed to Unkelus. Unkelus was a Ger, was a non-Jew converted. According to some, depending on the Gersa, he was actually the nephew of one of the Roman emperors. And we are told that Unkelus was a Talmud of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva, and he translated the Torah in accordance with their understanding. And so when we say, for example, the Targum, you said this lesson, the Targum was given to Moshe B'Sinai. You know, what does that mean? But then you say Unkelus wrote the Targum. So are you saying Unkelus is just recording halacha? I mean, that really doesn't make sense. But when we say it's recorded B'Sinai, that means the Unkelus's translations are the ones that Hashem gave to Moshe. Meaning not the words. The actual vocabulary is Unkelus's vocabulary. But his interpretation of the Torah is so MS that it will match what Hashem told Moshe. That's what it means. In other words, it's not that people think that the actual words of Unkelus were handed down generation to generation. Now, if you look at a Mikros Gedolos of Nevi'im, Yoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Malachim, Yishayo, Yirmiyahu, you will also see a Targum. Right? There'll be Rashi, a Targum. So who wrote the Targum on the Nevi'im? So the Gemara says the Targum on the Nevi'im was written by a different person, Yonasan ben Uziel. And Yonasan ben Uziel, you may remember from the Gemara in Sukkah, was a Talmud of the great Hillel. And in fact, Hillel had 80 Talmidim. And the greatest of the Talmidim was Yonasan ben Uziel. The least of the Talmidim was Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, who really kept the Jewish people alive spiritually at the time of the Churban. But Yonasan ben Uziel, it's interesting, he was the greatest of Hillel's Talmidim. The Gemara says, if a bird would fly over him, the bird would be burnt to a fire by the angels that would come whenever Yonasan ben Uziel would learn Torah. But it's interesting, we don't have a single halacha. Yochanan ben Zakkai is mentioned a lot, and many takanas that he made. Yonasan ben Uziel, we know nothing about, other than this. Apparently, Rav Yonasan ben Uziel was so great that he was not involved in political life, and he was not even involved in Pesach Halacha. In other words, Rav Yonasan ben Uziel was the person who all he did was learn and serve Hashem. He was not, in other words, he was actually not a posek. He was not somebody who paskin shailas. He was not involved in day-to-day life. So it's interesting that it's Bedavka of Yochanan ben Zakkai who is considered to be the pachos of Hillel's Talmidim, who was the most involved in the life of Am Yisrael at the time of the Churban. In fact, as far as we know, Yonasan ben Uziel didn't even get ordination, didn't even get smicha to be a judge, because he is not called Rebbe Yonasan ben Uziel. He is called Yonasan ben Uziel, implying he did not have smicha, which actually makes perfect sense, because the purpose of ordination is to serve as a judge and a posek. He wasn't interested in being a judge and a posek. He didn't get smicha. Okay. Not because he was not deserving, but because it was not what he wanted to do. Now, the one tradition we have about Rav Yonasan ben Uziel, which is not in the Gemara, is, you know where he's buried. He's buried in a very out-of-the-way place near Tzfat, Amuka. Very deep, deep valley. And it's brought down that it is a segula for unmarried people to pray for their zivuk at the kever of Yonasan ben Uziel. Now I think they fixed it up a little bit. I haven't been there in a long time. But it used to be pitch black. There were no, at night, I mean, there were no, it's very, very deep valley, and there were no lights there.
Still
at all.
No lights.
It's an amazing thing. I mean, you literally, all you have is the headlight of your bus or your car. So you look up at the sky, maybe that's why it's a makom mesugal for shidduchim. You see, a million stars. It's always bothered me from the time I was a kid. Hashem says to Abraham, your children will be like the stars of the heaven. I look up at the stars, I look up at the sky, maybe I see 10 stars. I don't see anything. I don't see anything so great, stars of the heaven. But if you're in a deep place, like a well or just a deep valley, and there's no other light, right? There's no other light, so all you have is the light of the sky. There really are. There really are. Like, now, I don't know, millions, I don't count them, but really, you can't count them. There are really so many. The sky is filled with stars. Mamish, Kekochve, Ashrayim. We don't realize how much light pollution affects us. When you have other sources of light, like electricity, whatever it is, you don't see the sky at all. So the Gemara says, though, that Yonasan ben Uziel actually wrote the Targum on Nevi'im. And that's why Rashi always quotes in Nevi'im, Tuf Yud, that means Targum Yonasan. Now, the Gemara then says, all right, so therefore, since Rav Yosef is quoting the Targum on Yeshayo Perek Ches, we can assume this is the Targum of Yonasan ben Uziel. Now, the Gemara in Megillah then says that Yonasan ben Uziel then continued to write the Targum on the Kesuvim. But there was a tremendous earthquake in Eretz Yisrael, that Hashem was going to destroy Eretz Yisrael unless Rav Yonasan ben Uziel stopped writing it. Why? What's so bad? What's so dangerous about a Targum on Kesuvim? Because in one of the books of Kesuvim, it's really only one of the books, in the book of Daniel, there are, which is Kesuvim, there are actually a number of verses that calculate the coming of the Mashiach. You can look at it. You can look at it. And if you learn the Mefarshim, you'll see fascinating things. Different Mefarshim tried to give dates, like whether it was 1250 or 1800, whatever it is, based on calculating. And all of these were guesses, and none of these dates happened. And since the Malbim was the last one, since the Malbim, our Mefarshim no longer try to figure out the dates. But Rav Yonasan ben Uziel would have given us the exact calculation. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, you're not allowed to do it. And that's why he did not write the Targum on the Kesuvim. Now, there is a Targum on some Kesuvim. It's not him. We don't know who wrote it. Now, one final point. Again, just to give you the general information. If you open up a Mikros Gedolos Chumash, you're going to see, in addition to Targum Unkelus, there is also something called Targum Yonasan ben Uziel. You're going to see that. But L'chaira, that, and in fact, it's very different than Targum Unkelus. Targum Unkelus is very literal, word for word for word. Targum Yonasan ben Uziel brings in a lot of midrashim. So it's more of a midrashic Targum. But still, you do have Akasha. The Gemara in Megillah says that Yonasan ben Uziel only wrote the Targum on Nevi'im. He did not write the Targum on Chumash or Ksuv. So because of this, many Mefarshim actually say that it's a printer's mistake, that Targum, that on the Chumash, it should not be called Targum Yonasan. It should be called Targum Yerushalmi, a Targum that was found in Yerushalmi. Now, there actually is a Targum Yerushalmi in the Gros Gedolos, but some say Targum Yonasan was just another Nusach of Targum Yerushalmi. So there's Targum Yerushalmi 1 and Targum Yerushalmi 2, but anonymous authors, but it's not Yonasan ben Uziel. So in scholarly academic literature, they call it pseudo-Yonasan, which is, you know, I mean, it's fine, because actually it is considered pseudo-Yonasan. That's not to say it's not Choshev, it's not to say it's not a very important commentary, but it's not Yonasan. In fact, it may be from as old as Yonasan ben Uziel, but it's not his own authorship. But be it as it may, this particular phrase where Rav Yosef says, Ilmale tirguma dehaikra lo havi yadana makiyamar. If it wouldn't be for the Targum of this Pasuk, I wouldn't know what it says. Rav Yosef uses this phrase in many, many Pesukim in the Gemara. So you see that Rav Yosef was a lover of the Targum Yonasan on Nevi'im. Okay. All right. So now the Gemara asks the obvious kasha. If Sancheiriv did have a green light, my time is Yonish. Why was Sancheiriv punished when he turned against Jerusalem? Hashem said to do it. The Gemara's answer is, when the Navi is saying, because the people have despised the Meshiluach, they're going to be swept away, well, who despised the Meshiluach? The people who didn't accept Malchus Beis David. Who are the people that didn't accept Malchus Beis David? The 10 tribes. So he has the whole wrong referent. That pasuk is not referring to the Jews of Yerushalayim, that pasuk is referring to the 10 tribes. Because the Jews in Jerusalem didn't reject Malchus Beis David. They stayed with Malchus Beis David. Navi, Aseres HaShvatim is Navi. The Navi was giving prophecy on the Aseres HaShvatim. Vahu, Sanhedrin, takes it as a green light against Jerusalem. Yoyiv Date Al Kuli Yushalayim. Okay. And now we say, Taka, Bon Navi V'Amar Lo. The Navi then says to Sancheirif. Now this is interesting because in the Tanakh itself, there is no direct communication between the Navi and Sancheirif. The Navi is Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu is only speaking to the Jewish people in Chizkiyahu. But here, what the Gemara is doing is, it's taking a verse that Yeshayahu said and making it a communication to Sancheirif. And the verse says, Lo mu'af liyasher mutzakla. Now again, these are, sometimes when you learn these Gemaras, you realize how important it is to learn Nach, because otherwise, you know, these psukim are all unfamiliar to you, and you know, the translations of it. But that's why it's a good idea, especially in Agadata, because Agadata is so heavily connected to psukim. More so than most of, and halachic portions also sometimes have drushos, but you know, many, many Gemaras can go on for a long time without any discussion of psukim. But in Agadata, we always have psukim. So it's very good when you learn Agadata to have a Tanakh with you, let it be an English Tanakh, whatever it is, and always look up the pasuk, because one of the things you'll discover is, and it's important to know this, that Chazal's drusha might be radically different than the Pashat Pshat of the pasuk. And this is a very good example. Loi mu'af liyasher mutzak lo. Mu'af, it's a hard verse to translate, but mu'af comes from the word ya'ef, to be tired and exhausted. And mutzak is to oppress. So literally, this is a prophecy as to how powerful the Assyrian conqueror will be. There is no exhaustion to the one that shall oppress you. In other words, the Pashat Pshat of the Pasuk is that Yeshayahu is telling Chizkiah how powerful Assyria will be. It will go all over, it'll do all of these conquests and never get tired. Lo mu'af liyasher mutzak la. There is no exhaustion to he that will oppress her, her meaning the land of Israel. But Rabbi Elazar ben Barachia turns it around, that it's not a threat against the Jewish people. It's a warning to Yeshayahu. It's a warning to Sancheirif. And the warning means this. Mu'af means the nation that is exhausted by the learning of Torah. And lo mu'af, Asher Mutzakla, is interpreted this way. The oppressor will have no power over the exhausted nation. The exhausted nation means Chizkiyahu's nation, who were exhausting themselves in Limud HaTorah. The oppressor will have no power. See, instead of saying Lo Mu'af, there is no exhaustion to the oppressor, it means the nation that is exhausted will not belong to the oppressor. It's a rearranging of the words. And it's actually making the statement that in the zechus of the Torah learning that was so powerful in Chizkiyahu's door, they were saved from this oppressor that would destroy them. Okay. Now, similarly, the pasuk goes on, Ke'es HaRishon, the first time, Hekel Arza, the land was treated leniently, Zevulun V'Arza Naphtali, the acharon hipid, but the next time will be very severe. Now again, if you opened up a Tanakh and you looked at the English verses, Hashem is actually telling him how devastating Sancheirif will be. There will be no exhaustion to the conqueror, because this is the second, before Sancheirif exiled the 10 tribes, he actually attacked the northern kingdom earlier, and he exiled two of the 10 tribes, Zebulun and Naphtali. But he was not successful for the rest. So the Pasuk is saying, the first time was easy. It was just Zebulun and Naphtali. But the next time will be devastating. Right? So that's the simple meaning of how bad it's going to be. But the interpretation is this. We interpret it in a positive way. When it says it was easy, it means Zebulun and Naphtali were vulnerable because they were makil, they were lenient in the yoke of Torah learning. But Acharon, but the people in Jerusalem, Hichbid, they assumed a heavy burden, and therefore they will be saved. Right? So these psukim are interpreted in actually an opposite way. But the truth of the matter is, what about the klal? Don't we have a klal that a pasuk is never taken out of its simple meaning? The answer is both meanings are true because they're referring to different people. Each of these verses has a double meaning. It refers to the 10 tribes and it refers to the city of Jerusalem. With respect to the 10 tribes, the pasuk means the oppressor will have no exhaustion and it'll be much worse than the first time. And that doesn't change. That Art Scroll translation is exactly what the pasuk means vis-a-vis the 10 tribes. But vis-a-vis Jerusalem, those same words are given a different meaning. That the oppressor will have no power over the nation that exhausts itself in Torah study. And even though the first time he was successful, that is because Zebulun and Naphtali were Mako. They only took a light burden, as opposed to Jerusalem that took the heavy burden of Torah, right? So this shows you an important idea, that prophecies are expressed in words that can have multiple meanings, and all of those meanings are true. Okay? Okay, we'll step right there.
How important was tribal association at the time? I mean, was it a little bit like today, like a little bit divided society?
Yes, obviously tribal association was pretty important. Number one, Eretz Yisrael was still divided into tribes, so there was this notion of tribes. But since the monarchy, and there's in the days of the Shoftim, they literally were like different nations, 12 nations. The Melech made it a federal republic, not a republic, a federal monarchy, so to speak, but still it was pretty important. There was a strong sense of tribal affiliation. We don't have that today so much. Okay, I'm getting to that.
Thank you.
Yeah.